Welcome to University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamerick. This Saturday, researchers from the University of New Mexico will hold a teach-in event as part of the movement Stand Up for Science. The national advocacy movement began earlier this year in the wake of what it called devastating cuts to federal research funding and infrastructure, as well as government censorship of scientific work. While many news stories have focused on private Ivy League schools, the Trump administration has actually targeted public universities and colleges the most with funding terminations. That's according to a review of Treasury Department data by the Center for American Progress. The cuts have disrupted studies and prompted fears of a scientist brain drain to other countries. On this month's program, we'll hear from a local coordinator with Stand Up for Science and three neuroscience researchers about their work and what they'll discuss at the public event on August 23rd. Kalina Fahey is a postdoctoral researcher in addiction science and is a local organizer for Stand Up for Science in New Mexico.
Stand Up for Science is an organization that is promoting and encouraging activism in the scientific research space. So encouraging people to basically become more aware about the importance of scientific funding in the US, how it shapes, you know, our discovery, our education, our economy, things like that, and really advocating for protecting science and scientific funding.
What was the origins of the movement? When did it start?
The movement was started by mostly early career researchers and graduate students in the beginning of this year. They organized a bunch of rallies all across the U.S. at the beginning of March. I want to say it was March 7th. And one of our organizing members, who's no longer with us because they moved or are moving for a job, just went, you know, no one's doing this in New Mexico. And we are a state that is humongously impacted by research. We have University of New Mexico is an R1. There's New Mexico State is also an R1. And then there's so many other universities around that provide so many resources through science to the state and then the nation at large.
And talk about the impetus for creating this. This was, I'm guessing, in the beginning of the Trump administration.
It was in response to them having some concern. They have proposed reducing scientific funding that would impact New Mexico pretty heavily, has impacted. There were grant cancellations. Some of them have been reinstated, but a lot of researchers also have concerns about the future of research. So that's a lot of people's livelihoods, but even beyond that, that's a lot of medical discoveries that may be lost. You know, there's amazing research that's happening at UNM, like microplastics research about what it's doing to our brain. A clinical trial was just approved to look at an Alzheimer's vaccine at UNM. All this kind of amazing stuff that we're doing that we want to get to keep doing because we want to improve the health and lives of citizens.
Talk about this event that's coming up on August 23rd.
Yeah, so this is a teach-in, and teach-ins are basically a way for researchers and scientists to connect with the community. I think so much of what we do, especially when it's neuroscience, feels really hard for people to understand. I'm not a neuroscientist and I have a hard time. And so I think this is just such a great way. We have three great speakers here who know how to tailor their research to general audience. So people have a chance to go, okay, what is neuroscience? Why do we study it? What are the benefits we get from this kind of research? And then also, you know, it just has a chance for us to also connect with people in the community and kind of hear their questions about things that they don't understand about science, that we can help communicate better, because there's definitely a divide between academics and the general public. And I don't know if we do ourselves any favors a lot of the time with the way we talk about what we do. So it's a chance to kind of build that bridge and connect that gap.
Well, we have three intriguing neuroscientists here today, and I wanted to start with Sam McKenzie. Sam, can you talk a bit about your area of research?
Yeah, thanks for having me. So our laboratory is interested in epilepsy and memory. These topics might seem like they don't have anything to do with one another, but in fact, many people who have epilepsy suffer not only from seizures, but also from memory problems. And it's a similar part of the brain, the hippocampus, which is often involved in memory disorders and in epilepsy. A third of people who have epilepsy have seizures despite taking the anti-seizure medication. And for those people, the kinds of treatments that are available are removing a part of the brain or implanting an electrode for neuromodulation to inject current. One of the strategies for injecting the current to try is there's a chip that's implanted that detects a seizure and then delivers the current to try to stop the seizure. We actually don't know how that technology works, even though it is effective. And it's also fundamentally reactive, meaning the seizure has already started. And so one of the things that our laboratory is doing is trying to use machine learning tools to predict when seizures will happen, and then to develop strategies to deliver the electrical stimulation in anticipation of a predicted seizure. We don't know how good these predictive algorithms need to be clinically relevant, meaning to stop the seizures. And so we've been working with the Comprehensive Epilepsy Center here to test our algorithms on scalp data, and we do animal models to try to see what kind of stimulation is going to be effective in stopping the predicted seizures in those animal models.
What kinds of animals could approximate human brain activity so this would be relevant?
Yeah, so there's a lot of different kinds of epilepsy models that exist in the literature, both rat and mouse. Actually, there's canine models, that there's dogs that spontaneously have seizures, and there's been a huge amount of work that has been done in the canine
model. I had two dogs with epilepsy when I was growing up.
And so a lot of this work is not only translational, meaning you do the animal work to help people, but some of the work that's done on animals can be done to help animals too. The work that we do in the laboratory is rodent, mice and rat.
What will you be presenting to people at this event? Because I can imagine it's hard to translate some of this into, even though epilepsy is obviously something a lot of people can identify with having a problem.
I'm going to be talking about the memory component because my other colleagues are going to be talking about the clinical applications, and I want to make the case for basic science. And so it's known that once you learn something, there's a period of vulnerability. Meaning that if you hit your head or if you have some kind of damage, you forget the things that happened recently, but not the things that happened a long time ago. And we know from animal work that the hippocampus is involved with this. If you take out the hippocampus, you forget the things that happened recently, but not long ago. So there's something magical that happens over the course of days and weeks that allows the memory to be stored in other parts of the brain. And I'm going to be talking about that kind of process that allows for the long-term stabilization of memories.
That sounds really interesting. What questions are you trying to answer and what sorts of solutions are you trying to find with your work?
So to dive in a little deeper with this, we know from animal research that if you record from the parts of the brain that are in the hippocampus that are involved in memory, the neurons there fire when you're in a particular location. And you can record from groups of these neurons as animals, and they've been discovered in people too, move around, they can fire in these sequences. Then when you stop, the same neurons fire in the same order. And that happens over and over again during sleep. So people think that this is the basis of dreaming. If you stop these events, you stop the ability for that long-term memory stabilization. We don't know what allows those neurons to be reactivated. We don't know what dictates how those neurons fire in the right sequence, even as the animal or the person is sitting still or is sleeping. That is a core focus of my research. I'll be talking about those kinds of experiments.
What led you into this field?
I think that there's a certain aesthetic to the kinds of explanations that exist in neuroscience. I think that we all have some insight into the inner machinations of our cognition, and the kinds of biological explanations just felt extremely satisfying to me. You know, why you need three different colors to make on your television set to make all of the different colors. How is it that touch works? How is it that you remember some kinds of things and not others? There's just a particular kind of aesthetic and to that kind of explanation problem solving that drew me in the field.
This is University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick, and I'm speaking with neuroscience researchers who will be part of a Stand Up for Science teach-in this Saturday at the downtown Albuquerque Public Library at 3 p.m. Stand Up for Science is a national movement to push back against federal cuts to science funding and research. I want to move to Nicole Mathis. Did I say that right, Nicole?
You can call me Nikki, but it's Mathis.
Mathis, Nikki Mathis. Nikki, I interviewed you a few years ago about your work on the Alzheimer's vaccine research.
Yeah, that Kalina alluded to. I'm still part of that part-time work trying to get that vaccine into clinical trials, which is really exciting, but not the focus of what I'm going to be talking about.
Oh, okay. What is your current focus?
So I've kind of progressed along the path. As Kalina mentioned, I am also an early career investigator. So I'm a postdoctoral researcher. I am trying to become a faculty member at some point in the future. I'm making steps to do that. And in order to do that, you need to differentiate yourself from your previous work. So I'm an expert in tauopathy and Alzheimer's disease. As Kalina mentioned, my vaccine targets tau. And I've extended my work by applying it to healthy brain aging. So more recent work has come out looking at the influence of alcohol on the brain as we age. And it turns out if you consume larger amounts of alcohol or have an alcohol use disorder, you're more than 3 to 4 times more likely to develop Alzheimer's disease or another type of dementia. And in fact, if you have a high use of alcohol during early to middle age, you could be exacerbating your actual onset and the progression of Alzheimer's disease. So not only will you develop Alzheimer's disease at higher rates, but the disease progression will be worse.
What are some of the questions you're trying to answer with this kind of research?
For my research, most of the work we have so far has only been conducted on human patients. And so a lot of that work has been looking at electronic health records, which are really helpful, but they're just kind of a snapshot in time. And they also only rely on self-reports.
And people famously don't report accurately.
Yeah. How often does the doctor ask you how much alcohol do you consume in a week? And how often do you tell them exactly how much alcohol you consume in a week? So we're often left just kind of correlating these disease prognoses and just assuming that we have the whole picture. And what I want to do is take a fine-tooth comb and actually examine this at a molecular level. So similar to Sam, I use rodent models of Alzheimer's disease to study how alcohol use changes their neural structure and exacerbates the disease pathogenesis. And I recently published a paper in the journal ACER, which is Alcohol Clinical Experimental Research, that did this in a tauopathy model. And we found that in these animals that consumed alcohol, they had a worsened gait phenotype. So they were walking very weird. And I also observed seizure activity. So I'm kind of taking a more nuanced lens to how alcohol could be exacerbating electrical activity in the brain as a function of this disease pathogenic mechanism. And so I hope to explore that more fully as my career progresses. So that would be the focus of my future lab.
I know there's been increasing focus in reporting on, you know, the impacts of alcohol, which seem to be far more than we had really assumed in our society. Are you at a stage yet to tell people like how much they should or shouldn't drink?
I don't feel that I can tell people to stop drinking, you know, or limit their drinking, but I do think that people should be taking a more careful glance at how much they do consume as a way to really protect their brain from aging. There are many groups that find a lot of modifiable risk factors for Alzheimer's disease, not just alcohol use. And these include air pollution, of which many researchers at UNM are doing this work, but also traumatic brain injury and physical inactivity, high cholesterol, depression, hearing loss are just a number of these modifiable risk factors that we can address or pay attention to in order to really help our brains age healthily. And healthy brain aging is the name of the game.
I saw, Nikki, that you're also part of something called Brain Bee. What is that?
So the Brain Bee is a high school outreach event that I'm incredibly proud of. The University of New Mexico has been putting it on for more than 10 years. We'll be in our 11th year this coming year. It's free to register. It's free to participate. It happens in the spring every year. We tend to open registration around January, and the event typically happens in February or March. And this is an event that the graduate students put on. It is an event that's meant to connect with the youth of New Mexico, as well as the community, to kind of tell these students, hey, have you considered neuroscience as a future career? So it's like a spelling bee, but for brain facts. We held some study sessions last year that were really popular. And so we hope to continue this event because it's such a bright spot in what we do in our outreach.
That's really cool. In terms of what you'll present at the Standing Up for Science event,
yeah, I think many of us have stories of our grandparents developing Alzheimer's disease, and maybe even other stories of our grandparents having a fond affiliation and association with scotch every night and thinking about how alcohol and brain aging is not necessarily a good combination. So I do want to touch on most of the clinical work that's been doing. I'll probably highlight some of the work I've done, but just to make it more approachable for an audience to actually digest the material and maybe take away from it that they need to think about their drinking.
I think from our earlier conversations, Nikki, one thing that led you into this field was you had a relative with Alzheimer's.
I did. I lost my grandmother to Alzheimer's disease right before I started my PhD program. And, you know, for many of those people out there who have lost parents and grandparents, uncles, brothers, sisters to the disease, it's a horrific disease. And anything that anybody can do to delay or prevent that from happening is something that we should really be researching.
You're listening to University Showcase on KUNM. I'm Megan Kamrick, and I'm speaking with neuroscience researchers at the University of New Mexico who will be part of a Stand Up for Science teach-in event at the Downtown Albuquerque Public Library at 3 p.m. this Saturday. It's part of the national movement Stand Up for Science to protest federal cuts to science funding and research.
I wanted to move to Fernando Valenzuela, not the baseball player, but a neuroscience researcher. I'm sorry, you probably get that all the time. Fernando, tell us about your research on alcohol in the developing brain.
Thank you, Megan, for the invitation to be here. It is a pleasure to talk to you and the audience of KUNM. So our work is on a condition called fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. And that is essentially an umbrella term that encompasses all the potential outcomes that can result from alcohol exposure during pregnancy, when the baby is developing inside the womb. It's a lifelong condition that will impact the life of the individual at many levels. It affects many organs and systems, but the brain is particularly affected, leading to deficits in similar processes as those that Sam and Nikki talked about, so learning and memory. So this is the opposite of the spectrum, right? We have Alzheimer's disease affecting more of the elderly population. Here you have an insult when you are developing in the womb that can lead to memory problems throughout life. And also there are issues with impulse control, with decision making, with emotional problems, and the increased incidence of certain mental health conditions, such as depression, et cetera. So it's definitely a condition that can have a tremendous impact in the quality of life of the individuals.
I would imagine lifelong impacts. People with this condition can also obviously end up in the justice system more.
Yeah, some of them can for different reasons, and it's a very complex issue. But you bring up an important issue is that the condition is heavily stigmatized when we're trying to reduce that issue, that people think, oh, it's a fully preventable condition, which is not the case. It's not that easy to prevent because in many cases, alcohol exposure occurs unknowingly until pregnancy is recognized or the individual has an alcohol use disorder, which is very difficult to treat, and they won't be able to stop drinking while they are pregnant. So it's a difficult condition, and we're trying to work on that, emphasizing first that when talking about the condition, we should avoid judgment, being quite compassionate and supportive, and offering resources and community support to those affected by the condition. And also emphasize there is really no safe level of alcohol consumption during pregnancy. It depends on the timing, the dose, the pattern of alcohol consumption, but it can have subtle effects or more severe effects depending on the person and many factors, including what Nikki talked about, air pollution, nutrition, etc.
What are some of the answers or solutions you're looking for?
So the solutions we're looking for are twofold. We're looking for better ways to diagnose the condition because it is very difficult to distinguish, for example, somebody with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder versus somebody who had alcohol exposure and has ADHD produced by the alcohol exposure. Sometimes they co-occur. So trying to distinguish those two things is challenging. And the fact that somebody drank alcohol during pregnancy sometimes is unknown because the child is in foster care or is an adopted child. So nobody knows for sure if alcohol exposure took place. So there aren't really 100% accurate biomarkers that can tell you when the alcohol exposure occurred, the dose, etc. We're working towards that. There has been a lot of progress, but we need to do more work on that. And the other angle is we're trying to find interventions to mitigate the damage, whether it is by giving some nutritional intervention, for example, during pregnancy, to try to mitigate the damage, or do it as the child is developing and growing at different stages of life. How can we intervene better to manage all the conditions associated with it? It's a moving target because it's a spectrum. So we get a wide variety of presentations, clinical presentations, that require very specific treatments. The other thing that I want to emphasize is the prevalence of the condition. It can be as high as 5% in the United States, the whole spectrum, right? So many, many of us have been exposed to some level of alcohol. Fetal alcohol syndrome was described in the 1970s. So before, nobody knew it was a problem. So it was okay to drink and also smoke and do other things, right? In those days.
Yes. Being a Gen Xer, I'm sure I'm
exactly.
Result of some of that. Fernando, why did you want to present at the Standing Up for Science event? What will you be presenting, and why did you want to be involved in this?
I'm passionate about interacting with the community and increasing awareness about this condition, which I think is often misunderstood, and the individuals and families that are dealing with it are facing enormous challenges, and we all, I love to increase awareness so there is more support towards those affected by the condition, maybe increase awareness to decrease the incidence of the condition one step at a time. The more people know it, they may tell their friends or family members, hey, you may want to change that beer for a non-alcoholic beer while you are pregnant. But it's only one drink. Nobody knows what that drink may do. You may want to pause while you're pregnant, and then you can restart again at the appropriate time after you consult with your doctor. So I'm very motivated about the gap in knowledge about the condition, how it affects individuals, and I want to contribute to finding solutions towards it and communicate that to the public so we can all work together to make the lives of those individuals better.
Sam, I wanted to ask you that same question. Why did you want to participate in the Stand Up for Science event?
I've been publicly funded to do my research since I was 23 years old, and I'm 39 right now. And I think that it's part of my responsibility and obligation to communicate what we do in the laboratories and to explain the science that we've learned over that time to the people who are paying for the work. And it's as simple as that in a time right now where it's possible that other people will be defending what we do. I want to make it clear that how important it is that the work is being done in the laboratory.
What about you, Nikki?
I would love to echo exactly what Sam just said. I think it's important that we as scientists who are funded by community tax-paying dollars to describe to the community what we do. Why is UNM important? Why is UNM the cornerstone of Albuquerque's economic powerhouse? Why is it important to continue funding science? And what do we do at UNM that directly contributes and adds to the community? Because it is so much. It is so much. And it is so worth saving. And it is so worth supporting.
Are any of you facing funding cuts?
This is a question for Tamara.
Oh, okay.
Hi, Megan.
You want to weigh in, Tamara?
Yes. We're just not able to really talk about specific funding cuts on specific funding projects at UNM. Things are just changing every single day, so it's impossible to know what cuts exactly are happening. I would be happy to connect with you offline to see if I can get you some better answers, but we won't really be able to talk about specific cuts with these group of researchers today, unfortunately.
Tamara, am I allowed to direct people to an online resource
Keeps track?
Okay, so yeah. If people are curious about how funding cuts might impact them in their state, in their county, they can go to, it's called scienceimpacts.org. And it is an independent group of researchers that are keeping track of this. They are also looking at the future. And based on the current administration's proposed budgets of what they would like to see happen with science funding, they also have some metrics of how this might impact your state when it comes to economic activity, as well as jobs lost, which I think is really helpful to see in states that do have a lot of economic activity. You know, it's not just about the money and going to science. It's people also, their livelihoods are funded through this. So that's a great resource that people can look to outside of like specific grants, a more general snapshot of how it might affect New Mexico or even the U.S. broadly. And again, scienceimpacts.org.
Great. I will put a link to that on the show's website.
Cool.
Kalina, can you say anything more about the event coming up on August 23rd? Anyone can attend?
Yeah, it's free and open to the public, and it's at the library's main branch, which is awesome. I know it's a great space. They have an auditorium. So we'll have, you know, the opportunity for some slides if people are more visual learners. It is open to all ages. I have confirmation that some people are bringing their children, and I know that these speakers do a great job of connecting their work to an audience at broad. So if your kids are really passionate about science, this is a great opportunity to bring them. If you're just a lover of science, it's great to come learn more. And like I said, it's also an opportunity for people to come ask questions about science, even more broadly. How does it work? Why do people use animals? Why, you know, that all that kind of stuff is totally available for people who are curious. In terms of anything else, it's August 23rd. That is a Saturday, and it'll be at 3 p.m., so in the afternoon. And again, that's Albuquerque's main library branch.
Great. Are there other upcoming events that Stand Up for Science is planning?
There is nothing on the books yet, but I'm connected with some people that work with humans, which is funny to say, right? If you work with humans, you don't really describe it that way, but I'm sitting in a bunch of room full of people that work with animals. I have connections with a lot of people that do a lot of work in the harm reduction space. And so we are interested in hosting a harm reduction teach-in at a brewery in town. If anyone's interested, please reach out. And we'd like to do these all across the state. So if anyone, you know, is not Albuquerque based and wants to connect with us about how to do a teach-in in their city, in their county, please reach out. We'd love to help support and facilitate that because there's so much science happening all over New Mexico. Like New Mexico State does so much agriculture and physical sciences in the environment that I don't have connections in. Madison is the co-lead with me for New Mexico. He's also in addiction science. And so, you know, we don't have those connections and we'd love to get those kinds of talks being done because that is such a big part of the research that happens here in New Mexico.
Well, sounds really interesting. Thanks. It was great to hear about your work and thank you all for talking with me.
Thanks
so much,
Megan.
Thanks, Megan.
That was Kalina Fahey with Stand Up for Science New Mexico, as well as neuroscience researchers Sam McKenzie, Nikki Mafis, and Fernando Valenzuela. The Stand Up for Science event takes place this Saturday at the downtown Albuquerque Public Library at 3 p.m. You can find this interview and all our University Showcase interviews at KUNM.org. Thanks to Associate Professor David Bashwinner for our theme music, and thank you for listening to and supporting KUNM.